Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Here's what happened in sports jersey history for February 4th. We talk about the great goaltending of Grant Fuhrer. And Ray Durbin of Row One Brand stops by to discuss his two favorite number 40s of all time. Listen in and learn about more sports history along with me from the uniforms and jerseys the players wore. And it's all coming up from you right now. Hi, my name's Darren Hayes, and I know you've heard me on the Pigskin Dispatch talking about football history for years. Well, now I'm on a new mission, a quest to find sports history in other sports, as well as football, by learning through the jerseys and the apparel and the gear that the players wore and the franchises supplied their teams. It's an educational trip, and I'm taking you with me day by day, player by player, uniform by uniform, the Sports Jersey Dispatch.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my sports history friends. This is Darren Hayes of Sports Jersey Dispatch, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. And we are here to talk about some great history of sports through the jerseys that the players wore. And we're going to talk mainly about February 4th. But we have Ray Durbin, our good friend from Row One Brand, a great sponsor of the program of Sports History Network, that's going to come on and talk about a couple of his favorite number 40s near the tail end. So hang on for that. But first, let's get you some of the historic events that happened on February 4th. And the first one happened in 1952. The legendary athlete Jackie Robinson, who not only helped break the color barriers in college football and Major League Baseball, climbed over another hurdle on this day in 52. On this date, number 42 became the first African-American to become an executive at a major television station, which was WNBC in New York City. February 4th, 1979, at the 29th annual NBA All-Star Game, which was held at the Pontiac Silverdome in Pontiac, Michigan, the West Stars outshined the East standouts by the tune of 134-129. The game's most valuable player was number 33 of the Denver Nuggets, shooting guard David Thompson. February 4th, 1986. Well, this is going to take us and guide us to our sort of our sports jersey player of the day. Is at the NHL All-Star Game, Hartford Civic Arena, the Wales Conference defeated the Campbell Conference 4-3 in overtime. Now, the MVP of that game was goalie Grant Fuhrer, number 31 of the Edmonton Oilers at the time. Fuhrer got his professional start in the AJHL with the Sherwood Park Crusaders and then moved on to the WHL's Victoria Cougars for a couple seasons, according to EliteProspects.com. Then he made his NHL debut with Wayne Gretzky and the Edmonton Oilers against Winnipeg Jets on October 14, 1981. Fuhrer became an integral piece of the Oilers dynasty of the 1980s by almost becoming an impenetrable stone wall in front of the Edmonton goal for most of the decade. Grant was part of the Edmonton squads that won 4 Stanley Cup championships in 5 years, and it wasn't just the great ones scoring, but the defense of the Oilers' net was a big part of the team's success too. In 10 seasons, Fuhrer had 11,059 saves with the Oilers in 423 games played. His average of saving about 90% of the shots fired over his career never really wavered through much of that great career. And everything was going pretty well for the young netminder. Then almost out of the blue, in 1989, the future Hall of Fame goalie threatened to walk away from the game at 26 years of age. At the height of his talented run, thanks to an apparent dispute with Glenn Sather and some really bad advice from his agent, Rich Winter. Much of this stemmed from Winter not getting along with Sather. Allegedly, the two had a confrontation in which they engaged in a session of shoving each other while trying to work out a new deal for Fuhrer back in 1987. And perhaps the saving grace for Edmonton, who notoriously was known to underpay their top talent, was that Rich Winter was able to secure Fuhr a 5-year contract with Pepsi-Cola that would have seen the future Hall of Famer have his Pepsi logo on each of his pads, starting with the upcoming 1989-1990 season. The contract with Pepsi was quite a good salary supplement on paper for Fuhr. There was one problem, though, however, with it. The NHL did not allow for individuals to have advertisings on their persons. They wanted a standard uniform on every player on a team, and this fueled the heat between Fuhr and the Oilers even further. It drove a wedge in between them. He literally filed the retirement papers with the club, but Sather never filed them with the league offices, and eventually things settled down in the dispute. And Rob Soria, on the HockeyWriters.com article of July of 2021, wrote this: "After coming to this realization, it was that the NHL and not the Oilers who was prohibiting from putting on the deal with Pepsi into action, his stance softened. On October 24, 1989, it was made official that Fuhr would be remaining with the Orange and Blue. Though his agent did him no favors with the approach he took, the fact that the situation turned into the fiasco it did was on the player. After a couple of more lukewarm seasons of contract dispute, suspension, an injury, Fuhr was set to make his return in the crease in the 59th game of the 1990 season. It had been nearly 2 years since he was on the ice healthy. The goalie shed his normally colorful pads and wore mainly white ones to represent his clean new start. Apparently, in the background, he had been battling some demons, and now after a year of mending, he was ready to rekindle his hockey career. His comeback game against the New Jersey Devils showed he was back as the Oilers won 4-0. He ended up regaining his status as a top goalie on the squad eventually and convinced the league that he was indeed back to old form. Fuhr departed the Oilers in 1991 and went on to play with Toronto, and then Buffalo, Los Angeles, St. Louis, and Calgary before calling it a career after the 1999 season. We salute number 31, Grant Fuhr, for overcoming his personal obstacles and giving to others the inspiration and hope that may be in the same circumstance that they too can recover and thrive in life. And that's why number 31, Grant Fuhr, is our sports jersey of the day. And what a great story that is for the great hockey legend. Our next story in history takes us to February 4th, 1990 at the NFL Pro Bowl in Aloha Stadium in Honolulu, Hawaii. The NFC defeated the AFC 27-21, and the MVP was Jerry Gray, the Los Angeles Rams defensive back. Now, February 4th, 1996, the NFL Pro Bowl in Aloha Stadium, Honolulu, the NFC defeated the AFC 20-13, and the most valuable player was number 80 of the 49ers, wide receiver Jerry Rice. February 4th, 1997, the Pittsburgh Penguins number 66 star Mario Lemieux became the seventh National Hockey League player to reach the plateau of scoring 600 goals in his career. We just had another one just the other day we were talking about. February 4th, 2001, another NFL Pro Bowl game, Aloha Stadium. The AFC defeated the NFC 38-17 that year, and the MVP was none other than number 12 of the Oakland Raiders, quarterback Rich Gannon. In 2001, number 13 of the Boston Bruins, right wing Bill Guerin, was selected as the most valuable player of the 51st NHL All-Star Game played at the Pepsi Center in Denver, Colorado. North America defeated the world 14-12. Where's the defense in that game, huh? The fans were there to watch some pucks being put on net. In February 4th, 2007, Super Bowl 41, Dolphin Stadium, Miami Gardens, Miami, Florida. The Indianapolis Colts eased by the Chicago Bears 29-17, and the game's most valuable player was an Indianapolis quarterback Peyton Manning, who wore number 18. In 2018, on February 4th, we had Super Bowl 52 take place at U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Philadelphia Eagles surprised the New England Patriots 41-33 to take home the Lombardi, guided by the Philly special play. The game's MVP trophy was given the recipient of that now-famous pass play, Philadelphia quarterback Nick Foles, who wore number 9 in the big game. And like we said, now I want to take you to our sports jersey take of the day. It's by Ray Durbin of Row One Brand, as he speaks of the comparisons of his two favorite number 40s. We have our friend Ray Durbin. And for those of you not familiar with Ray Durbin, we've talked to him on Pigskin Dispatch quite a bit. He is a great sponsor of the Sports History Network and Pigskin Dispatch, and we appreciate him. And he is also a great historian and preserver of great history of sports and all sports with his Row One brand. That's R-O-W-O-N-E brand.com. Make sure you check out that website. We have some links on Pigskin Dispatch and Sports Jersey Dispatch. It'll take you to Sports History Network to get some discounts. Ray Durbin, welcome to the Pigpen.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here again and visit with you about some outstanding football players. As I understand, this particular program is going to deal with famous numbers or numbers of athletes that I'm particularly fond of. I guess I'd like to proceed by talking about some of my favorites that were number 40. Well, basically, I started out, one of my favorite players since the time I was a little kid was Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch. And I guess the reason I was initially enamored with him as a player is the fact that I liked that nickname, Crazy Legs. And also, at that point in time when I first started watching pro football, not that many teams had the iconic uniform like the Rams did, with the actual Ram horn drawn on the helmet, painted on the helmet. And so I was all fired up about that when the Rams would play my beloved Lions. I couldn't wait to see Norm Van Brocklin, Crazy Legs Hirsch, Tom Fears against and their quarterback, either Bob Waterfield or Norm Van Brocklin, and of course, Bobby Wayne quarterbacking for the Lions. So I've always been intrigued by Hirsch. When I started looking into this a little bit to get some items of interest, I found out that you had previously, the Pigskin Dispatch had done a program on athletes who had worn number 40. I think you did a program back in May of 2021. Very interesting. I really enjoyed listening to that. Just so happens in your program, you and your associate that you're interviewing, a representative of the NFL, you categorize him as Sayers as being the greatest player to ever wear number 40, Gale Sayers. And I think Elroy Hirsch came in number two. And I want to flip-flop that.
Okay. Hey, that's great. I mean,
Just briefly on Elroy Crazy Legs Hirsch, he was born in 1923 in Wisconsin. He was an outstanding athlete in high school, and then he attended University of Wisconsin. Freshman year, I don't think they were eligible back then when they were freshmen, but in the 1942 season, he started as a sophomore. He was all Big Ten. He led them to an 8-1-1 record. They won all their games, and the only one they lost to was University of Iowa, beat them 6-0. But in that, they had a tie against Notre Dame 7-7, and I think what was interesting, they upset the previous year's national champion, Ohio State, by a score of 17-7. So, and that was basically attributable to Hirsch. He was all-purpose back. He punted. He ran punt and kickoffs back. He passed. I think probably at that, maybe we're running a single wing or something like that, where a lot of times a halfback or a back would throw the ball more than they do now. And he was just an excellent runner, pass, receiver, everything. Now, what's interesting about Hirsch, he played 1 year at the University of Wisconsin. They had a really, really good record. And then in 42 during World War II, or 43 after the 42 season, I believe, he enlisted in the Marines, and they assigned him to University of Michigan as part of their program where they would train college graduates, and they had a program at University of Michigan. So he wound up starting for University of Michigan in that following year. What was interesting, all the sports writers and everything said that this was a government's lend-lease program to University of Michigan to get him over there playing for them. And he did really, really well. I think I have my years right, 42 and 43. He lettered in four sports: football, basketball, track and baseball. So he's an outstanding athlete. One story was in the fall, spring of 43, I believe, he participated in a track meet in Ann Arbor. And he had a broad jump of 24 feet, two and a quarter inches or so. Then that same day, he traveled to Columbus, Ohio to pitch in a game, and he pitched a one-hitter, and Michigan beat Ohio State 5-0. So that's his background. He's just an excellent athlete. He, after the war, he was drafted in the first round, number five, by the Cleveland, what was at that time the Cleveland Rams. And then they sub, this was in a 45 draft. He got out of service, I believe, in 46. But he didn't want to go to L.A. At that time. He wanted to play in Green Bay, but the Rams had the had his contract rights. So he wound up signing with the Chicago Rockets and played a couple of years there. And so that's kind of interesting that Hirsch and Gale Sayers, we'll talk about in a few minutes, they both started their professional careers in Chicago. And after Hirsch played there for a couple of years, the Chicago Rockets kind of took a nosedive where they went, the league disbanded. And so he then was picked up by the Los Angeles Rams and began his career there. He had an outstanding professional career. I'm not going to go into all the details, but both he and Sayers were on the all. He was on the 1950s all-decade team. He was on the all-time all-pro team. I'm talking about, both of them. He was on the 50th anniversary NFL team, 75th and 100 year. They selected the players for the all-NFL team, I think, in 2019, and both of them were selected. Now, for each one, the groups, you know, they might have four or five receivers on that team. And so how good you are, in part, is who you're surrounded by. And in this case, the people that were selected for that all 100-year team in terms of receivers are people like Rice, Fitzgerald, Lance Allworth. Of course, Elroy Hirsch was on that for a receiver. And you know, probably about six or seven best receivers in the history of the NFL, and he was selected that. You know, after his playing career, and he set all sorts of records in the early 50s when he was playing for the Rams in terms of receiving. Back then, the Rams were kind of a high-powered offense, you know, at that time. It was in 51, I think they won the championship, NFL championship. And he just had numerous records, everything. Now, after he left the Rams, he went into sports administration. He was a general manager for the Rams for a period of time. And then he was subsequently hired as the athletic director by his alma mater, University of Wisconsin. And he spent a number of years there. The other thing interesting about Hirsch is he was in business. He made movies. I think about four or five movies to his credit, one of which was a story about his life. He played that role. And this was probably made in the mid-50s, so he had the acting. Now, I'd like to talk just a little bit about Sayers because they have a lot of similarities. And I wasn't aware of this. It's interesting. They were born 20 years apart. I think Hirsch was born in 23. Sayers was born in 43. Roughly the same time of year. Sayers was born in May and Hirsch was born in June. They both had their numbers retired in college. They're both excellent college athletes. They were really basically pretty similar in size. Hirsch was 6 feet two, 190 pounds, and Sayers was 6 feet. 198 pounds. Like me, he probably ate a few more chocolate chip cookies than Hirsch, so he was able to put on a little more weight. But they're both really great players. The other thing I found very interesting was some of their similarities. They were both drafted by the NFL in the first round, and Hirsch was drafted number five that year in 45, and in 1965. Sayers was drafted in the first round, and depending on the source, he was either draft number four or number five. I saw one reference his draft number five, but they said the NFL drafted number four and the AFC drafted number five. They both started their careers playing in Chicago. It's interesting how much influence wives have, but I can see that at that point in time, he had a choice of going with the Kansas City Chiefs or going to the Chicago Bears. And his wife, I think, encouraged him to go to Chicago. There's probably more activity there at that point in time. The other interesting thing about him, that the similarities, I think I indicated maybe if I already covered this, they were both football players and they both were track athletes, pretty good. And they both engaged in broad jump. And I think I gave that figure of Hirsch at a meet, had a broad jump of 24 feet, 2 1/4 inches. About 20 years later, or wouldn't have been 20 years later, but when Sayers was in high school, he set the Kansas high school record for broad jump, and it was 24 feet, like 10 inches or so. So they're both really gifted athletes. Of course, Sayers, his career was kind of cut short. I didn't realize it was as brief as it was, only about 7 years, and part of that time he was injured, but just the records that Sayers set. The other thing that struck me about Sayers, of course, I watched him and that, but his yardage rushing was almost identical, real close, to the yardage he gained in kickoff and punt returns. It's just real, real dangerous runner. I think I mentioned the fact that he played at University of Kansas, and I saw him play one time in person against Oklahoma, and all the fans rooting for Oklahoma, they were just on pins and needles every time a ball came anywhere close to him. And 1 year they upset Oklahoma because he returned a kickoff 93 yards, the opening kickoff, he returned to 93 yards. George Halas said he was probably the best back that he had ever seen, or ranked up there with all the great backs that he coached, like Red Grange and all. He was just really high on Gale Sayers. And again, it's unfortunate he didn't play a longer period of time. The other thing about Gale Sayers and Hirsch, a lot of similarities. They both had head injuries while they were playing. Now, I know that sounds like kind of trite because a lot of players have head injuries, but that they were relatively significant. I think Sayers was probably due to more of a repeated, concussive effect of being tackled so much and all that kind of stuff. Hirsch got kicked in the head one time and they had to make a special helmet for him. So going through, I know that sounds kind of trite, like you could say, well, they both wore shoulder pads, but it is kind of interesting that they both had significant head injuries, so much so that, you know, they think Gale Sayers later suffered from dementia due to his head injuries, while Hirsch had, they had to make him a special helmet. The other thing that's interesting about them, they're both really bright, bright individuals. They both, after their playing career in the NFL, after having their numbers retired, they both got involved in sports administration. I think I talked about Hirsch being winding up athletic director at Wisconsin. Sayers started out as an assistant athletic director at Kansas, his alma mater, and then he became the athletic director for Southern Illinois for a period of about 8 years or so. And then he went into business and had a very successful company, computer support company. Another interesting thing is the fact that they did have some relationship to movies, that kind of stuff. We talked about Hirsch being involved in some acting out in Hollywood, but also Gale Sayers was sort of involved in that story about Brian Piccolo, made for TV thing. And my understanding from your program earlier was that maybe they based that on Sayers' book that he had written about, or maybe I think they did. That could be the story of my life too. I come third behind my dog and my wife. grandson. But it's interesting. I think he said he put God first, and then his family and friends.
Yep,
came third, something like that.
Exactly right. That's exactly what he said. Good human being.
But that you know, kind of some of the information surrounding why I particularly like the number 40 as a football jersey number.
Well, Ray, that was, I mean, great insight, great knowledge and research on both those men. And I'd never realized the comparisons till you brought them up tonight. That's extremely interesting. Their size and their careers sort of had a parallel trajectory 20 years apart. Right. But I also want to mention on your Row One brand Pictorum Gallery, you preserve the history of both these men on the Pictorum Gallery. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about those pieces of art you have.
Well, I think we have some photographic art of Gail Sayers. And also there's a artwork involving Elroy Hirsch, which is in the form of a diagram of him on the cover of a book called or a little pamphlet that was put out by a company out there in California. And it just so happens he's on the cover of publication number one. But the name of this is The Fine Points of Football Offense. And it's an interesting cover. It shows him running and catching a ball. And of course he was an outstanding receiver for his time. They said he was able to sort of like Willie Mays in that famous catch he made where he caught it over his head, over the shoulder catch. They said that was just par for the course for Crazy Legs Hirsch. He wouldn't look from side to side or turn his head or anything. It'd just take off down the field. And either Norm Van Brocklin or Waterfield would throw him a ball, and he would tilt his head back and try to see the ball coming over, and then he would run to it. I mean, they'd throw it straight, and he would just tilt his head back and try to find the ball and just keep running. The other thing interesting, just real briefly about his, well, how he got his nickname Crazy Legs, and again, you know, an interesting thing is just some of these players I never thought about until we were talking here. Might be interesting to hit stories about all of the weird or iconic nicknames of some of the players. Now, maybe you've already done that, and I apologize if you have, but and Hirsch, they said he got his name because when University of Michigan was playing at Great Lakes Naval Academy, or it could have been the University of Wisconsin, but I know it was Great Lakes. A sports writer said, his legs are going every which way. You know, they're going like eight different directions and da-da-da. And he said he looked like the crazy legs, and he looked like a demented duck the way he was running. And he did. His feet were kind of splayed out or something. I guess he had a funny gait, but it was really fast. So. I tried to pattern myself after him, but someone said his father also said what he would do. He would run and skip to school when he was a kid. He would run all the way to school and skip and run. And the sidewalks, he'd try to cross his legs over as he was running because he thought that would make him more elusive. So
whatever he did, it worked.
It did work. So. I guess as far as number 40, that's about all I can offer.
No, but hey, that is fantastic. And I wanted to mention, you know, the Gail Sayers on the Pictorum Gallery. I just went to Ray's site, Row One Brand, and clicked on the gallery. It takes you to the Pictorum Gallery. I typed in Gail Sayers, and this piece of art came up, 1966 Gail Sayers Chicago Bears photo art. And it's a black and white during a game. And Sayers is like, he's running, but he's like midair, and he's got a lineman, you know, trying to throw a low block on a, it looks like it might be the Lions in this photo too. It's hard to tell. So it might be, that's one of the games that you were watching as a youngster when you're watching Sayers.
Right.
So, yeah, But he's floating in air with an official in the background. It's a great piece of art. Look great on anybody's wall or coffee cup or shower curtain or whatever you want to do. Ray can help you out there. And we have a links on the Sports Jersey Dispatch podcast website and on Pigskin Dispatch and also sportshistorynetwork.com. And Ray is generous if you go through one of those links to give a discount on anything you buy on that Pictorum Gallery. So make sure you take advantage of that by putting in the code SHN15. So Ray German, we appreciate you coming on. We appreciate your preservation of sports and for supporting us here on the podcast and the Sports History Network, and appreciate your time today.
I appreciate the opportunity. I always enjoy listening to your programs and listening to you.
Well, that was a great comparison by Ray. I never realized how much those two were alike. Some great job by Ray Durbin. Make sure to check him out, Row One Brand. We have links to it on the sides, left sides of both Pigskin Dispatch and Sports Jersey Dispatch, and also on Sports History Network. Check out Ray's great wares that he has, Row One Brand. Also want to thank our music, Gene and Mike Monroe, for that great reggae in the beginning. And then Jason Neff with his tune that you're hearing right now in the background, and the one that's about to play in a second in our closing credits. Also, we couldn't do it without the great resources of On This Day, newspapers.com, the sports reference sites of pro football, baseball, hockey, and basketball reference. Couldn't do that without them. They bring them some good information that we like to share with you. And please make sure you check out their websites as well. Till tomorrow, everybody, have a great sports day. We're dribbling around and see the shot clock's almost out, so we got to put up our shot and come back tomorrow for some more great sports history. We invite you to check out our websites, jerseydispatch.com and pigskindispatch.com, not only see the daily sports history, but to experience the preservation of great events and people that play the games. Find us on Pigskin Dispatch. It's also on social media outlets of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all your daily sports history. Pigskin Dispatch is happy to be associated with the Sports History Network, the sports headquarters of yesteryear, found at sportshistorynetwork.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.